Looking dapper. In honor of Kingsman, the Golden Circle, what's your favorite pop culture British person in a suit?
I'm Katie Rich. I'm proud of coming up with this question, and I'm going with the kid in the blue velour suit when they first shoot the music video in Sing Street.
I'm Matt Patches, and I hope alien characters count as Brits, because I'm going with David Bowie in The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, Tim Curry in Clue, because
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going with James Bond. I don't understand how this wasn't taken by now.
Typical and boring from David. Snooze. Always trying to go with the popular thing.
His movies only had one ending.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 182 and it's Tuesday, September 19th. And on this day, what a day. It was George Washington's farewell address as president. Dave, I bet you can recite some of it from memory right now, thanks to Hamilton.
I probably could if I had been thinking about Hamilton at that exact moment.
I always think of Hamilton.
Is George Washington in Hamilton?
Oh, Patches, obviously.
Hamilton. The guy who's saying, we'll get to the Emmys, or the guy who's saying the In Memoriam at the Emmys plays George Washington in Hamilton.
Roger Ailes?
Roger Ailes.
No, wait, he was dead and Roger In Ailes. Memoriam, I say. Right.
Okay, famed star of Hamilton. So we're all back in one. We're all back together after a couple weeks of travel and film festivals and Hawaiian beaches. But
I am back in body, if not in spirit.
Well, thank you for dragging your shell of a body back into this podcast.
You're very welcome.
Somehow we gave you guys so much time to leave us new reviews, and we don't have new reviews. This is distressing. Apparently, you didn't like me and Dave singing the DuckTales theme enough.
Or me just rambling on about the movies that I watched on a plane. Why is that not? I'm giving you people everything.
They got the gold. So please leave us reviews. We really like it. We appreciate it. We need new listeners. And David will decide whether or not you're helpful or not as a person.
But probably not. Statistically, yes.
Yes.
But for you, who knows?
It's the dream.
So one of the many things that has kept us apart and traveling was the Toronto Film Festival, where David and I have just gotten back, which is very exciting. I saw David, I believe, twice, both times in bars.
Yeah,
never
but,
in a movie
but
theater.
What a time we had.
Oh, I mean.
Those two times.
Yeah, I got to hear all your tales from Telluride, because you'd just been at another film festival, and I feel like I could ask you about what you saw, but I don't know. Is it all a blur for you? Because it's all kind of a blur for me.
Yes and no. I mean, I think that what I saw at Telluride is sort of largely negated or rolled into what I saw in Toronto. It doesn't necessarily matter where I saw what I saw, but I spent most of Telluride just getting a slight head start on what was going to be at TIFF. So most of the movies are applicable to a wider conversation.
And also most of the movies, or at least most of the movies I saw, will all be coming out in theaters over the next couple of months. Many of them will be vying for Oscars. So while we're talking about stuff that isn't out yet, it's not so far away. Patches and Dave, you guys watch it from a distance. What are you curious about from this huge glut of film festivals and all these movies?
Well, my big takeaway, I'd rather not talk about Lady Bird because I know you're ecstatic for it, and I just want to see it later. No, don't do it.
Phenomenal.
David and I are going to be united front on Lady Bird. It's fucking amazing.
You're hyping it up too much. Ugh. Well, I mean, that's the point.
Because Lady Bird is a very small movie. It is, it's Greta Gerwig's feature-length directorial. I mean, it's her solo directorial debut. She co-directed a movie. Once upon a time, but it is a small movie in which Saoirse Ronan essentially plays the Greta Gerwig proxy, growing up and graduating from high school in 2003, Sacramento, It is not a particularly huge movie. I think because of its quality and when it premiered, it was sort of thrust into the Oscar conversation, but had it premiered at Sundance, it could have been a different conversation, even though it'd still, you know, be every bit as deserving to be there. But, yeah, I mean, I don't want you to think to sit down and expect something like, Blade Runner 2049 or this like,
whoa,
yep, that's what I was expecting.
And that's what, yeah, that seems like measured expectations.
Is Saoirse Ronan a replicant?
Scale. I don't know. It's just like Lady Bird is one of those movies that like the moment it started and immediately launches into its rat-a-tat pace, which will be very familiar to anybody who saw Mistress America. I was just like totally on board, and it's so good. It's just like, and it really, really got to me, in a roundabout way without any sort of saccharine scenes or beating you over the head with anything. The sheer sort of velocity of watching this girl grow up and her relationship with her mother is played by Laurie Metcalf. It's overwhelming in its honesty, and I was completely bowled over. And, if it was not my number one favorite film of the year, it's right up there. I have yet to see how things are going to play out. But Katie, what did you love about it?
I loved basically all the things that you've listed. I also was in high school in 2002, so it's almost like I got out of the movie being like, is anyone else going to like this? Because I love it, but I remember when everyone dressed exactly like all the people in this movie. But other people did like it, luckily.
How did they dress?
I don't want to overhype this movie for you, like you say, because I think there's a danger here, but Lucas Hedges plays a theater kid who wears like that sweater that everybody had from The Gap that had like the stripe across the chest, like right under the neckline. You know what I'm talking about?
Maybe.
Hey, Patches.
Did you wear that sweater, my friend?
Hey, Patches, what's your favorite Sondheim show?
Well, I don't want to. I don't know. Company?
No, pick another one.
they Sunday in the Park?
We roll along.
Oh, I would never have guessed that.
All right. So, well, Lady Bird will be out in a couple months. We'll have more time to talk about it. I want to talk about it, but also don't want to overhype it because I do think that's a concern. Like, I didn't manage to see everything at TIFF, nor did anyone. And I didn't get to see The Disaster Artist, which premiered at midnight, the night that I left. And I'm getting kind of worried that, like, so people love The Disaster Artist at that screening, but I'm kind of concerned that the amount of affection for it is going to set me up for something that it's not going to be able to match.
I will say, I was at that midnight screening. It is, without question, one of the most sublime movie-going experiences of my entire life. You know, it was an absolute pandemonium there. Tommy Wiseau and Franco and everyone else were there. There were plastic or inflatable footballs being thrown around, etc., cackling at every line. I have absolutely no idea. And I say this as somebody who, like, was weeping. I was laughing so hard by the end of this movie. How this film will play outside of that room at that time. I heard that it absolutely slayed the more sedate press screening the next morning, but even worked really, really well for people who had no familiarity with the room. But I still, because they really Judd Apatow-ize the story of the making of the room with The Disaster Artist, it becomes sort of about this unlikely friendship. They sand off all the darker edges. But James Franco gives, the performance I've seen this year. I think if I had to give out a best actor trophy right now, I would not think twice about giving it to him. Good luck, Daniel Day-Lewis. But in all seriousness, I mean, it's the thing he was born to do. Both he and his brother are phenomenal in this. But Katie, to your point, I really don't know how that's going to play for a wider audience.
It's funny because Toronto usually isn't the place where you get stories like that. Like, I think Toronto's a really big festival. You can see films in a lot of different ways. And you don't get something like at Sundance where everyone's like, oh my God, my experience watching Me and Earl and the Dying Girl changed my life.
Hey.
Not to make fun of you, David. I know that movie mattered to you. But that movie kind of, at sea level, like, didn't have the same impact. And usually Toronto doesn't do that. But The Disaster Artist definitely had that vibe about it.
Yeah, I mean, The Disaster Artist premiered at South by in a, quote, unfinished form.
Which is also, like, the ultimate, like, raucous screening environment for that kind of
thing. Yeah, and it did well there. I mean, there are only so many room fans that could really propel this into the zeitgeist, but I do think that if James Franco continues to get some sort of awards attention, and I know that A24 is prepared to have that conversation, it could be a thing. We'll see. It is, you know, it's the movie that it wants to be. It's very gentle. It's very light. But especially once they get into the making of the room within the movie, it just every scene slays so hard. And there's so many great cameos and all the performers from Jackie Weaver to...
Jesus Christ, Jackie Weaver's in this thing?
Oh, is she ever? And wow. To people, I'm not going to name some of the people in there because I think a lot of it is best saved. Even though the trailer, the full-length trailer they released, gives away a few of the surprises. But it's going to be an interesting case, that's for sure.
Dave, what are you curious about?
What was that movie? Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri?
Yeah, so that one won the Audience Award, which I was surprised. I have not seen it, so David might be able to explain better, but I was surprised to see that was the Audience Award winner, since it didn't have the kind of, like, feel-good inspirational thing that a lot of Audience Award winners usually do.
Well, I know exactly what you mean, and you're right, but...
I mean, it's a Martin McDonagh movie. I assume there's a lot of cursing.
There is, but it does, It starts with its tragedy and builds towards a happier place, for sure. That is not a spoiler of any kind. It's a Martin McDonagh story about Frances McDormand plays this woman who lives in or just outside Ebbings, Missouri. And before the film starts, her daughter has been raped and murdered, and the police, who are run by Woody Harrelson, the police department there, have not exactly been doing their utmost to solve the case. There is not a lot of evidence. And so she buys these three decrepit billboards and puts up some very, very confrontational messages. And it's sort of from there, with Sam Rockwell playing the, dumbass, Martin McDonagh style dumbass, deputy to Woody Harrelson, becomes a story of the cycle of hate and forgiveness. It's a movie that worked very, very well for a lot of people. I liked but didn't love it. I think the plotting is a hot mess, even though it builds to a phenomenal final scene. And there are some really, really great performances, even though I think that Frances McDormand is fun as it is to see her be this ferocious. Her performance, like the character, just doesn't really grab me at all. Woody Harrelson is really the only one here who does, because I think Sam Rockwell's character is too dumb by half, and Woody Harrelson is not in the movie very much. This movie didn't... Like, I wanted to like this because I subscribe so strongly to a lot of the messages that it's putting forward, but it didn't stick with me in the way that it did with a lot of people. But I do think that it is the 2017 equivalent of a feel-good movie in its own way.
Oh, boy. That seems like a weird, like, damning with faint phrase. Like, this is the best we can feel in 2017. It has to start with rape and murder.
I mean, yeah, kind of.
Oh, boy. Patches, do you have any other TIFF questions? You're just going to wait for it all to come to you.
Well, to answer your first question from the beginning of the segment. What's interesting is you're talking about, like, awards and stuff. And there was a big article during TIFF and Telluride where I guess the trades were trying to, like, both have their cake and eat it too by damning critics who were talking about awards and awards and awards and awards. Everything is an awards conversation.
Wait, what?
To the TIFF and... Telluride. What do you mean?
I wrote an article saying that critics need to start embracing Oscar hype.
No, I'm not talking about your article. I'm talking about other articles that were more.
There are other articles?
Yes. Believe it or not, this is not a solo opinion. But actually, people were damning it. Yours is in praise of awards. It's the reverse of every other year. But my question is, usually we walk away from these festivals being like, okay, here is the clear front runner. Here is the clear winner at the end of the year. And I mean, Moonlight kind of took off in that same way after Telluride in Toronto last year. I don't feel like there is a front runner this year, which is exciting. I don't know what is the movie that's going to kind of blow people up, but maybe we haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are two answers to that question. And Katie, you are more award savvy than I, so take it away in a sec. But I think... the two answers that are one, the two big movies this year, both won't screen until the end of November. And they are most prominently Steven Spielberg's The Post and kind of the Paul Thomas Anderson movie, but Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't really do the Oscar game anymore. He doesn't make movies that are sort of engineered for that, but Daniel Day-Lewis is in it and it could be his last performance. So it goes. And the other part is that the year's big colossus, not colossal, is Dunkirk, which is already out and will be on Blu-ray soon and is a lock for a Best Picture nomination and is going to win all the same categories that Fury Road won. And that is a done deal. So
that's a done deal. Okay.
It's a done deal.
Sure.
I still think Dunkirk has a pretty good shot at Best Picture. As
Katie, do you disagree with me that it's a done deal that Dunkirk's going to win a lot of those awards?
I think so. I mean, I think there's an interesting conversation about Darkest Hour and Dunkirk as two wildly different movies about weirdly the exact same thing. But we can talk
Don't forget Their Finest, a movie I watched on the plane, which is also about Dunkirk.
Yeah, it is the season for Dunkirk. But the only thing I would add is that I feel like it always kind of gets to this point in September where we get out of Toronto and everyone likes a lot of things. There's a lot of conversation and everything feels kind of unsettled. And then within a couple weeks, there does seem to be a front runner and it usually settles down in that way. It's kind of hard to say because I agree that there doesn't feel like a front runner, but we've been here before. And for all we know, Wonder Wheel is going to premiere at the New York Film Festival and just lock it all down.
Wonder Wheel has screen for people and that's not going to happen, but Kate Winslet will probably be in the conversation.
Listen, I saw much of her movie where she and Idris Elba are trapped on the side of a mountain and
I was
doing these red carpets at Toronto and I kept having to leave just for scheduling reasons. Liked it just fine. It's very silly. It will not be her Oscar movie, but I look forward to seeing the rest of it someday.
I don't know if I want to do this on air. But I bet that you and I could, with a slight margin of error, name the movies that are going to be nominated for Best Picture today.
Oh my God! Should we write it down and then do it at the end of at the end of the episode?
Sure.
Yes.
All right. That's an incentive to keep listening.
Stay to the end.
I'm gonna get a pen.
I watched clips from them, like I do with award shows.
Okay, Dave watched clips of the Emmys. The rest of us, I think, watched the Emmys. So we should start with you, Dave. Dave, what clip did you watch of the Emmys?
I watched, like, the opening monologue through the Spicer thing, right? And then I watched
some of the
speeches.
Colbert's dance, where he danced with...
I'm glossing over the dance.
Stranger Things, which...
I'm also glossing over like the clips and stuff. The comedy of it wasn't really what I was in it for. I was in it for like some of the history making winners and their speeches. So I was like the person that would like watch things on Twitter and then search YouTube by upload date for such and such like Donald Glover directing speech.
Hmm. Was that the highlight?
That's the way I watched the Emmys this way. Was that the highlight for me? I don't know. It's sort of like the joke in the Stephen Colbert monologue where he's like, it's the most diverse field three times in a row. Like, I can't believe you guys could applaud and clap yourselves on the back at the same time.
Right.
Like, I'm happy that we are getting more diverse winners, Emmy winners, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we're going to ask for, you know, going back to a white Game of Thrones fields next year. So who knows?
So if it's not clear,
those are my general feelings.
Yeah, if it's not clear, in this mini segment, we're talking about the Emmys, which I thought personally were relentlessly boring, like more than usual, or maybe I don't know what's happening to the Emmys. How can TV be so important to people and the Emmys be so boring? I mean, even the Oscars has like goofs and maybe it's just funnier stars or better stars or better writers manning the ship. Why is
the
ceremony so bad?
Felt boring or like all the intermittent stuff or both?
Maybe there's just too many categories too. Although, I don't know, it lasted just as long as the Oscars. Yeah, all the speeches are boring. No one's getting up there and raising hell and no one's getting up there and crying their ass off. No one seems to really care about getting an Emmy. Except maybe Kate McKinnon, which was nice. But
this was the thing that's like they set aside like all this time for Nicole Kidman, or they obviously like decide not to cut her off, and she's just giving a speech, and you're like, Nicole Kidman doesn't really care about winning an Emmy. Like, she seemed very like collected. Whereas then Sterling K. Brown wins his second Emmy in a row, and they cut him off, and he seems to care a lot more. It's kind of a bad calculation,
especially because he was in the middle of giving like the most genuine, eloquent, impassioned award speech I'd seen in a long time.
A certain amount of time for like supporting actor, and then the best actress and best actor get more time.
Shouldn't the Emmys know a thing or two about making good television? Like, don't they recognize
because all
that
the good directors are off doing other shows, and then they get stuck with
them.
No, that's rude.
I was only like, there were only comedy categories that I had dogs to like in the fight for, because I didn't watch a lot of streaming dramas this this season, and I didn't watch Big Little Lies. That's what it was called, right? Anyway, point being, it was the amount of television that there is now, I think, I know I'm supposed to have opinions about all of these shows, but it feels like too many shows to have opinions about.
And when Jean-Marc,
it's not like I don't
an Emmy, you know, you just hang up your hat and go to sleep. What's the point?
Yeah, my condolences.
That's what I said.
I'm not going to say no to an award show. I just the idea that I could be bored at any point just never occurs to me. Like, it's like a, like, it's just a force
hashtag
of nature
on
that I'm there for. I don't know.
Yeah. Because of the, like the betting aspect, the, like, who could win at any, I mean.
No, just at, like. Just so, like, I want to see who wins. I want to see the speech. I'm going to, you know, there's going to be... The In Memoriam was, like, unusually awful this year. But, you know, that's also a thing about, that's part of it.
What about Jermaine Fowler doing the commentary live?
I mean, that was fun. He had pep. I want to watch his sitcom now.
You know what I liked? What I liked about that is...
Tracy Let's Play.
So they give all the... they give the credit for there being a, you know, unusually diverse amount of winners, especially compared to the Oscars. But I like that they had this black comedian doing the announcement in what is usually like a, you know, sonorous white man voice. Like, it's just... it was a nice, like, bit of diversity that... You know, it drew attention to himself because it was a comedian instead of just a random announcer. Yeah. But I liked it. It was a... It felt like it's a simple thing to do that made it feel less white.
You know what would have made it even better? If literally anything that came out of his mouth all night long was not insufferable.
What are you talking about? Why?
I thought it was funny.
He was funny.
His shtick, I mean, I think everything that Katie just said is right on the money. I just thought that the individual they got and the jokes that individual chose to tell were abominable. Truly atrocious. And I had the opposite reaction to Patches, where I said, I vow never to watch anything this person is in.
You don't want to see Superior Donuts, the CBS sitcom based on Tracy Letts' hit Broadway play?
Yeah, you love Tracy Letts because of Lady Bird.
Yeah,
I love Tracy Letts because I stood behind him in line for the porta potties at Telluride.
That is the most insidery thing you have ever said.
Watch Superior Donuts.
I mean, that is the ultimate example of star fucking, I think.
I mean, well, depends what you did in the porta potty later.
Did you literally fuck Tracy Letts in the porta potty?
Yeah, okay. Yes, I fucked Tracy Letts in the porta potty.
That is unsanitary.
Why wasn't this part of our festival segment?
Got to make him work for it, you know? You get the story if you go to the second part of the episode.
Jermaine Fowler was good. Everything was fine.
Yeah, I liked him.
Everything was just fine. I just wish it was like, how could it pep up? How could it be more exciting? Why are there no stakes? Is it just because it's the same shows every year? And yet, I'm in conflict with myself because I saw a lot of people complaining that Julia Louis-Dreyfus should not submit herself in the Emmys anymore because she's won too many, or she, you know, she broke this record, I think, held by Candace Bergen, is that right? Who won the like tons for Murphy Brown or whatever. And then now
she's won the most for playing the same character.
Same role. And then some people are like, hang up your head, you know, don't submit yourself. Give another person a chance. It's going to be the last season of Veep. Let the woman dominate. Who cares?
Listen,
she's competing against
Big
people
Bang
like
Theory.
Modern Family. What? Come on.
The Big Bang Theory didn't win anything. It's a good year for America.
Well, luckily, young Sheldon's going to be on and dominating next year. Hopefully,
yeah,
Jacob Tremblay gets a show.
But we have to talk about Sean Spicer. I feel.
Yeah,
we do.
Fuck that guy.
Bad.
Yeah, fuck that.
Bad.
Yeah, that's a bad decision.
It's bad, but everyone's
I don't know
blaming
how you...
Colbert. Is it Colbert's fault?
Apparently, it was his idea. Like, he was the one who suggested it in the meetings for planning the show.
The problem
Oh, sorry. What were you gonna say?
I was just going to say that in theory, it's hilarious. Like, if you're there, you bring Spicer out because he is such a media whore that he will say yes, and you laugh in his face. That's what everyone's doing. Everyone's like, Jesus Christ, this guy
tactic.
Is such a... Right. Colbert. It makes sense with Colbert logic, but for the audiences at home, it's not funny. Like, you're just
my
like,
problem
this is really
was,
happening.
My problem had less to do with the bit itself than it did with all the glad handing that Sean Spicer did backstage.
Yeah.
I mean, all the, the people, you know, including like someone like Seth Meyers, who has otherwise been so good.
Yep.
At putting this administration's feet to the fire, you know, they're all smiles with Sean Spicer. And I understand that, a photo can be taken out of context and who knows what happened in that moment. It certainly looks pretty damning. And there is a sense, as I've seen a number of people say on the internet today, that at the end of the day, as righteous and valorous as some of these people, these very, 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 very wealthy white men can be, there is a disconnect between the people who Trump's policies directly affect and those who they don't as directly affect.
Yeah. If only Larry.
I'm not saying Sean Spicer can't have some sort of like media resurrection, but it can't come before a sober reckoning with what he did to the media. Like, you know, I want to, you gotta break him down completely and then build him back up. Take him back to the Easter Bunny, Sean Spicer, and then see what grows out of the rubble.
But you can't do that.
Why not? You don't have to be part of his rehabilitation. Like, he's going to go get embraced by conservative media or think tanks or whatever in D.C. Like, if you are someone who objects to the Trump administration, you don't have to be there to, like, help him get a new job.
Oh,
like,
right. The public eye. Well, that's why I just said, I'm like, I wish Larry Wilmore was there. It's all these like white late night comedians. And again, we're just, you know, you're waiting for someone to actually roast this guy, even if it's behind the scenes, even if it's all these that you're right, David. What the most insufferable part of this was seeing all these pictures. Joe Monde, the comedian, was posting every single one with no commentary. And it was everyone was retweeting them. It's just so disgusting. I actually, during the show, I kept thinking, can you imagine if like Charlie Chaplin is sitting at the 1941 Oscars and for The Great Dictator, he's nominated Best Picture all across the board. Then like Hitler comes out.
Okay, and just, all right, hang on. Sean Spicer.
And we got there. Right to Hitler.
That's what I'm imagining.
Dumb, terrible things. He is not Hitler.
Hey, let me write my 1941 Oscars fan fiction. Please. Well, right, there's one good thing that happened because of Spicer. Okay. Just to wrap things up. That Anna Chlumsky gif, jaw hits
good.
The floor. That's incredible. So there's a silver lining to everything.
Give her an
We got a good reaction gif out of it. So
2017 in a nutshell.
Worth it.
Conversation to things I have not seen Mother. I tried to, I look forward to, got to it yet. Also, we're going to spoil Mother in the course of this conversation. So if you haven't seen it yet and unlike me, don't want to be spoiled, listen to it after you've managed to see it. Because it does feel like, you know, for when I was at Toronto and I saw all these people kind of arguing amongst themselves about it, they were trying to keep it spoiler free and it was very confusing. So it does feel like you can't really talk about this movie without getting into what it all means. Am I right about this, those of you who have seen Mother?
What it all means. I mean, yeah, its entire purpose is to be one blunt force allegory metaphor. So, I mean, you will naturally talk about what it means. But I don't know if it's that deep. What you're suggesting.
No, I guess I don't think that it's deep, but that if you can judge whether or not it's an effective movie, you kind of have to talk about whether or not its central metaphor works, which is not what is in the advertising.
I actually don't know if David likes this movie.
David doesn't know if David likes this movie. I think I go back and forth on Mother because on the one hand, I had so much fun watching it.
Oh, I was giggling and terrified and my brain melted. I'm in the enjoy to camp.
And it's a part of my nature to want to love any film, particularly a studio film, that is this fucking gonzo. And
it gets an F CinemaScore.
And that Paramount, to their endless credit, released a statement saying, like, we know that some people aren't going to like this movie. We don't give a fuck. Not every movie is here to be safe. Now, they have to continue backing that up with the rest of their slate, but it's so rare to see a studio go to bat for their more difficult films.
I think this full quote must be read. If people haven't heard this, this quote is from the president of marketing distribution for Megan Colligan at Paramount. She says, this movie is very audacious and brave. You are talking about a director at the top of his game and an actress at the top of her game. They made a movie that was intended to be bold. Everyone wants original filmmaking, and everyone celebrates Netflix when they tell a story no one else wants to tell. This is our version. We don't want all movies to be safe, and it's okay if some people don't like it. You burnt, Netflix.
It's a great point. It's a great point because Netflix can release bombs all the time, and there are little titters about, like, oh, Gypsy didn't get renewed or whatnot. But because they are so confidential about their numbers, we get to watch them fail, and we don't have to, like, you know, jump on them and bully them for doing so, for trying to take chances. Whereas in Hollywood, all of your failures are in Hollywood, traditional Hollywood, are in full view of the public, and the way that we react to them disincentivizes Hollywood from making more adventurous movies. And so I thought this was really really a brilliant move on their part. But I think
you didn't sign my change.org petition to bring Gypsy back for season two? Is that what you're suggesting?
I didn't. I'm sorry. I didn't know that was going around. My problem with Darren Aronofsky has always been that he cannot do two things at once. He is a one idea at a time guy, and his films are always incredibly simplistic for that result. As a reason for that, I mean, I think that he sometimes, he has this very symphonic approach where he is not maybe unlike Christopher Nolan, is trying to bring this one idea as crystal clear as possible, often through brute force, to borrow a phrase that Patches just used. And I think what made me like a film like Mother maybe more than I did something like Black Swan is that at least the first time that I was seeing the film and was thinking about it in my own terms, what he was doing was not so obvious to me. And talking to people about the movie afterwards, there were so many conflicting interpretations of what had happened in the film that even though it's clear, listening to Darren Aronofsky and sorting through a lot of the perceptive reactions that came out of the critical community, that he was as much as ever drilling down on just one idea, one possible interpretation. I think a movie like Mother is a great example of how the least interesting person to listen to about a given film or work of art is often the person who created it. I mean, he will tell you that Mother is a very cut and dried metaphor about Mother Earth and the way that humans treat it and the cyclical nature of our planet and how humanity destroys it and then the slate is wiped clean and the cycle begins all over. Because I'm a fucking moron, and I never think about anything sort of religious or anything like that, was not thinking about the more biblical elements of the story, which are also built into that sort of environmental aspect. And I really just sort of watched this movie as a story about a couple and how they are trying to maintain this relationship while also, like, figuring out how much to share who they are with the world outside of the perfect little bubble they've created, and also a sort of mea culpa from an artist about how, and you see this a little bit in the De Palma documentary as well, reminded me of this, how artists are sort of doomed to, no matter how ideal and idealized their partner is, to always be wanting more, to always be sort of unfulfilled because of their artistic drive. And I think the movie works on that level as well, in spite of what Aronofsky's approach
might
be.
Hold on. So you're saying that Aronofsky can only do one thing at one time, but I think the successful aspect of this movie is this kind of duality of microcosm and macrocosm. It's doing these two things at once. It's being a huge story, adapting the entire Bible, talking about our earthly plane and our place in the cosmos, but it's also a very effective relationship story about an artist oppressing his wife without realizing, while still trying to adore her. It's both of those, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean that just could just be his reading of the Bible. The movie is very conveniently split into Old and New Testament sections right down the middle. If you're wondering why Ed Harris,
we should talk a little about what the movie is actually about, like what happens in the movie, because I don't know if everyone has seen it.
Oh, there's a good Reddit thread called...
Well, I'm going to stop you right there, Dave. That sounds unlikely. Continue.
It was called Mother for Dummies, and it goes through the entire plot, but just starts with Javier Bardem is God, Jennifer Lawrence is Mother Earth. Movie starts, she wakes up like, yo, where this motherfucker at? And continues in such style, explaining how she's taking care of the house and she's sort of connected to the house in a way that there's like a heart in the wall and she's drinking some stuff. And then God is this artist who's sort of blocked. And then eventually Ed Harris shows up as a house guest, but he's Adam. And through like a wound on his torso, which is we're supposed to take as the rib, then Michelle Pfeiffer shows up and she's Eve. Then the Gleason brothers show up and they're Cain and Abel.
Yeah, they are.
And then then they get in like a fight, and we all know what happens there because we all know Bible things. And et cetera, et cetera. And then apparently the breaking thing is they break a sink and that's the great like flood. And then after that, has to impregnate her.
Well,
is that not the switching point?
I don't think it is, but there are multiple instances. There's like a scene where it's raining. I feel like that is actually Noah. And that I don't know. But the point is all of this feels true to me. Like, you could say anything and I'd believe it, because the text of the film is so manic that it could be a biblical reference, or it could be an allusion to climate change, or it could simply just be this kind of, theatrical surrealism, you know, just having. So later in the film, people keep coming over. You know, the reason we had that house guest lightning round question last week is because people just keep coming over to her house. They're intruding. And the sensation of that alone is this is a true horror movie. It's a true invasion picture where like everyone is invading her space. And that in itself is a thrill and just insane.
Someone described this movie to me as an introvert's nightmare, and that really spoke to me, because that was more than anything what was on my mind watching this. So I was just like,
as people who listened to the last episode know, I've been watching a lot of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I couldn't help but think of Larry David in Mother, like watching people sit on his sink or like watching people make out in his bedroom. It's like that's a nightmare. Jesus.
I think the real test for Mother for me will be watching it for a second time, now that I am not just in shock about what I'm seeing and sort of trying to keep pace with what the movie is doing and where it might be going. I think that for me, it's that second viewing that determines an Aronofsky film. I remember being so high on Black Swan the first time I saw it and so thoroughly bored the second time I saw it. So the jury's might be still out for me. I'm definitely leaning towards the positive, though, and I would love to see... It's strange to say more films like this, because only Darren Aronofsky is going to make more films like this, but it's great to see studios taking chances. I enjoyed every minute of watching the movie.
I immediately wanted to see it again, I have to say, even though the ending of this movie is completely devastating. How spoily are we getting? Pretty spoilery?
I think we said all spoilers. I know how it ends.
Okay, I mean, yeah, so she gives birth to a baby that is then... consumed by God's followers or Javier Bardem.
Yeah, Pashas, as a future parent, I'm curious about how you handle that, because I feel like that might be my one breaking point on this movie.
I immediately got out and texted Michelle, you are not seeing this movie. you can see it after you have
your delicate wife can't handle a baby.
I just don't think a pregnant woman needs Mother in their life now.
I certainly do not think that.
Well, especially there's a lot of violence towards Jennifer Lawrence. This is a really... It looks like a very physical movie. I mean, he puts her through the ringer as she navigates his house, and there's some serious violence.
And then immediately afterwards, she decided to date him. So.
Yeah.
I mean, they probably got pretty close.
What do you think Rachel Weisz was up to this weekend, watching all of this unfold?
Rachel Weisz is happily married to James Bond. I don't know if she has any problems.
Yeah. Well, she did, and now she's out, and is doing great for herself.
But, yeah, the movie takes such a toll, and yet I wanted to go back because, I don't know, I felt like I had Stockholm Syndrome. The movie is intensely squared off on Jennifer Lawrence's face the whole time. I'd never seen her give a performance like this where...
I didn't write the story, but there's a great story on IndieWire that my colleague Chris wrote talking to Darren Aronofsky about it. Darren Aronofsky. I just call him Darren Aronofsky. It's so much easier.
Darren Aronofsky.
Darren Aronofsky about his method. And Darren Aronofsky said that 66 minutes of the movie, 66, are Jennifer Lawrence's face in close-up.
Wow.
I mean, it feels that way. I talked to Darren Aronofsky a little bit about Son of Saul because the photography reminded me so much of it. And lo and behold, apparently 2 years ago at TIFF, he saw Son of Saul, and befriended, I don't have the director's name off the top of my head. Katie, what was your favorite film of 2014? What was the name of the director of Son of Saul?
I think it is
Laszlo, yeah. And they just like hit it off, and they're obsessed with each other. And this movie seems to be like directly spouting from his love for Son of Saul, and you can feel it. I mean, all of those close-ups in that movie with the Holocaust stuff happening around them, it's just like what you're experiencing in Mother, except now you're contained in a single house where the geography is Escher-like and the color schemes are all brown and drab, and then you have Jennifer Lawrence in this kind of white, you know, see-through shirt and she's just mouth agape the whole time. I've just never seen her like this. She's always played a very intense character or someone who's had to kind of, you know, build up a shield against the world, and here she's totally vulnerable in a way. I mean, she really has range. I've always been a little skeptical of Jennifer Lawrence, to be honest, and here I think she does everything. It's incredible.
Wow.
And then Javier Bardem shows up and just
maybe to wrap up the conversation, I feel like the theories about why this got an F Cinema score as compared to, you know, other movies that have are pretty solid. But I'm just curious, you guys who have seen it, like, what is it that makes people so mad when they leave the theater?
Well, actually, can I field this one? Because yeah. Java saw it and did not like it.
Yeah.
I feel like she was not expecting an allegory and maybe found it self-indulgent. Maybe, like, I don't know. Definitely the angle of it that seemed to frustrate her the most was the frustrated male artist constantly gaslighting his wife angle, and then just the descent into craziness didn't work. And then I think, like, we had just watched Get Out for the first time for her, like, the day before, so I think, like, she might have been whiplashed between two different types of horror, and you know, been maybe expecting like a Rosemary's Baby or like a weird vampire movie that's, you know, more like Black Swan or something. Well, it was definitely, she was shocked and found it self-indulgent.
The cinema score comes from people watching trailers to this movie and going out to see Jennifer Lawrence's horror movie and probably having seen It the weekend before and being like, I need to keep the good scary times going. And this is not a Hollywood horror movie. This is not a psychological thriller, even in the Rosemary Baby sense.
But also, and there were
the marketing material for the movie had those clearly red herrings as we look back, but the Rosemary's Baby poster is just, it's a gag. It's all a gag.
Right. But like, also something that really interfered with the film's ability to do well at the box office was It, and the fact that it had a $60 million second weekend.
I think this would have been much bigger without that. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, what are you going to do? Crazy clown movies just coming out of nowhere.
God. Dead babies and killer clowns. There's just no end in sight.
Well, we got some, you know, Thor and Star Wars coming up.
That's true. If there's a killer clown in Star Wars, I'm out.
There's a killer clown in Star Wars. I will have opinions, but I don't want to say that I'm necessarily out because maybe I'd be really into it.
Just a whole lot of porgs, whatever the fuck those are.
they're in Mother 2.
It looks like they're edible.
I would love nothing more after all these people bought toys for a movie that they haven't seen yet for the porgs to turn out to be like fucking Holocaust deniers or something.
Last Jedi is going to be a lot like Mother. The porgs are going to consume Jennifer Lawrence's child.
Oh,
Jedi
I would
child.
Love it. I want to be the boy to warm your mother's heart. I'm so scared to take you away. I try to win her over right from the start, but something always got in the way. We've been sitting in your backyard for hours, but she won't even come out and say hi. While my mother baked a little cake for you and even dreaded when you said goodbye. What
kind of car wheels do I have? All right, before we wrap this up, as promised, David and I, and also Patches, we have decided we are going to predict what's going to be nominated for Best Picture, because a lot has changed since we first started this podcast, and this is something David does willingly now, and I'm very excited.
We live in strange times.
David, first important question. It's a sliding scale of how many nominees there are, so how many did you go with?
Well, I mean, I think that there will ultimately be 9 nominees. There usually are, right?
I'm not sure there were 8.
Eight or 9 sounds right. I had a short list of 11 films that, you know, I think, per what you were saying earlier, based on box office alone, I think we'll know a little bit more in just a couple of weeks. But I'm ready to run this down fearlessly.
Yeah. Last year there were 9. I was wrong.
Right.
Just run it down. You know what? Like, you can explain yourself if you want to, but I also think this is the space to just fearlessly say what you want and reap the consequences.
I can give one line for each. Dunkirk is number 1. It's a lock. Done. 2, I think this is actually risky, but because the smaller films don't always translate, but Call Me By Your Name, so good, has to be in there. 3, 3 Billboards, got all this love at TIFF. I think that'll make the cut. 4, The Post, Steven Spielberg's film, or The Paper. I think it's going to be called The Post. That Spielberg, you can't go wrong. Even Munich got into the Best Picture combination, that late Christmas release. And that's going to be a lot darker of a film. 5, Lady Bird, I think it's going to get in there. 6, I'm a little less bullish on Darkest Hour's Oscar chances than Katie, because I think that traditional Oscar movies, as we think of them, are on the way out. But, I like Darkest Hour a lot. It's going to get a shitload of technical nominations, and Gary Oldman is a lock for Best Actor nomination, so, I think that'll push into the conversation. So Darkest Hour. Now we're getting into the iffier territory, and I am going to say that The Shape of Water could pull it off. Fox Searchlight only has so much money to spend around, and they have 3 billboards as well. But who knows? I think The Shape of Water, I don't really like it that much, but it's got the right vibe. It won Venice. I don't know. And then I also have Battle of the Sexes, begrudgingly. Not a good movie, but... could hit the right buttons. And then in my last spot, I am torn between Molly's Game, which killed me. I thought it was fantastically entertaining. And Phantom Thread. Ordinarily, I would kick Paul Thomas Anderson out of this conversation at this point. But I think the subject matter combined with Daniel Day-Lewis, who knows? So, and my wild, wild, wild card before I'm done is Blade Runner 2049, because people, if Arrival got in the conversation, I know people have seen Blade Runner 2049. It's getting pretty strong buzz. Jared Leto, worst movies with Jared Leto have gotten nominations before, I think. So anything's possible. So that's where the conversation is for me. Katie.
All right. Okay. So we overlap on a good number of them. I'll just run those down real quick. Dunkirk, The Post, Darkest Hour, Billboard, Shape of Water, Call Me By Your Name were all on my list. I didn't do them in like order of likelihood, but I would probably roughly agree with what you were saying. I'm really having a hard time on Shape of Water because Guillermo del Toro movies tend to be weird, and I don't know if it's going to be weird in the, even though the definition of an Oscar movie we've been saying is changing.
She fucks a merman, Katie.
I know, man. I have a hard time seeing it. I wanted to go with my heart and put Lady Bird, but I'm kind of wondering about the Florida Project, which I haven't seen, Ooh. So I don't know how weird it is, but they're both A24 movies, and kind of the general rule of thumb is that a studio to get two into Best Picture takes a lot of work.
I think that I'll let you finish.
Oh yeah, I'm curious if A24 will have it in them to push them both through, when we also talked about how The Disaster Artist might be a contender for them.
Florida Project is an extremely beautiful movie. I love it to bits. It would absolutely deserve a Best Picture nomination. I do think that, much like Tangerine, it's a little bit too much outsider art to get into the conversation. I do think Willem Dafoe will get a nomination for Best Supporting Actor. He's wonderful in the movie. That's what I think.
Yeah, I'd be curious about it. And then the last thing I had that I can't believe you didn't even mention, Get Out. Get Out's going to get a Best Picture nomination.
Oh, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I had Get Out on my list, and I don't honestly know what happened to it. I concur.
It got out.
I concur, for the record.
It's been such a shitty year for studio movies that I think both Dunkirk and Get Out are going to have a lot of strength of just being like, okay, so there's still some good things we can do. And also, this lineup that we just listed is very, very, very white.
Yes.
So I think Get Out's going to go a long way towards
Get that. Out will be nominated for Best Picture. Kick out Phantom Thread.
Sorry, maybe, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Maybe Battle of the Sexes.
I also have Big Sick as kind of like a sidebar on my little list. I don't believe in it a ton, but it does seem possible.
It'll get some Golden Globe nominations.
We're gonna bring Patches back because he's been not listening to your guys' picks.
Oh, rude. He's been in an isolation.
Rude.
Yep. All right, Patches is coming back.
Nice.
Hello.
Hey.
What up? Oh wait. So
what's gonna
my...
win that picture, Patches?
They covered a lot of grounds, but let's hear yours.
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how many movies there will be. Is it usually what, like? Seven,
it's usually
eight?
Nine.
Seems to be
it
the,
can be between yeah. 5 and 10. I went with 8. I think David had 9.
Okay. I think I'm going to do. Wait, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 movies. Maybe I'll throw a 9th in just in case. So I put them in alphabetical order. I'm going to say Call Me by Your Name. I'm going to say Darkest Hour.
Do you want me to tell you when we also chose them?
Oh yeah. Or, well, people know
David
already.
David and I both chose Darkest Hour and Call Me By Your Name.
I might throw Downsizing in if there are
No.
A lot of other people like it besides you. So
no.
That's
just
me. Yeah.
Who?
I stake my good name behind the fact that we're
right. That's definitely my least... That's the swing spot for me. Dunkirk. Get yep. Out. The Shape yep. of Water. Three Billboards.
Yeah.
The Paul Thomas Anderson and the Spielberg, The Post. And then Geostorm. If it comes out.
Yeah. Well, what David said we thought was way too bold at the beginning of the show, that you could roughly predict what's going to get nominated. We all really picked the same ones, which could just mean we're all reading the same shit and don't know anything. But I do think that's a pretty good list we all just came up with.
Well, We've seen what's going to pop, and then there's some late contenders, like we were saying. There's no front runner, though. Like, if you had to pick a winner, what would you pick now?
I'd pick Dunkirk.
Yeah, today it's not even close.
I wonder if I think Call Me By Your Name can, like, rev it up and go. I wonder.
It's a big question mark, because it's, we've seen
it's so
that,
striking, and people, it yeah. really seems to get under people's skin, and then the fucking, yeah. like, last... I don't want to over-talk about this because it's not coming out for a little while, but obviously, like, the last 20 minutes are just knock-you-out
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, I mean, future Stuhlbarg. Academy Award nominee Michael Stuhlbarg will definitely have something to say about that.
Yeah, so...
But,
I love that.
That's why I really believe that the movie will... You know, Sony Pictures Classics bought it in January or before... knowing that it was going to be a big Oscar horse,
right.
and they are prepared to put the money behind it and make that happen. And Michael Stuhlbarg will have people walking out of that movie.
Nolan's on the campaign already. He showed up to TIFF. He didn't have a movie, but
Nolan
he decided to show
to
Dunkirk anyway.
But Nolan
also
is,
on Call Me By Your
Nolan
Name,
is playing the winner, the winner's game right now, not the nominee's game.
Right,
because he knows he's in.
On the Call Me By Your Name thing, Timothée Chalamet, who's the main character, if he gets Best Actor nomination, which I think will happen, he'd be like the fourth youngest
yeah.
ever.
Really?
He's like 21, so that's exciting. And, you know, I rewatched The Social Network recently, and Armie Hammer is overdue.
Well, yeah. Fuck all the young people. That's the end of the show.
tune in again in March when the Oscars finally happen.
Jesus.
March this year. They're, yeah, the Winter Olympics pushed them to March. It's going to be... so long. Okay.
I'll have a kid by then.
That does it for... yeah, you will have a kid by then.
My
You're going to watch the Oscars with your kid.
Shut up, kid.
Little,
I'm watching the Oscars.
Alfalfa. Little Josefina. What's his name?
Alfalfa Patches?
It's a girl,
Josefina
right?
Alfalfa Patches. Yeah.
It's a girl. So Josefina Alfalfa Patches.
Yeah,
there we go.
That works. Okay. That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We will be back next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes. You can read any notes that we have. You can leave your own comments about the episode. We'll read them. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all my writing on IndieWire. You can find all of us together if you've already left a review on iTunes, especially, or if you're listening to us from another country, on Facebook. Facebook. It's more transparently evil than it used to be. Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find my writing currently at Thrillist.com and, of course, my other podcast, Storm of Spoilers is doing the off-season tour. This week, we're doing the Tremors franchise. Did you know there was a television series? There was. And five movies.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com, where on the Little Gold Men podcast this week, I'll be talking a whole lot more about the Oscars if you didn't get enough on this. And why would you have? It's the Oscars. Everyone wants to talk about them all the time. You can also find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H, and all of us on Twitter at F-I-T-W-R, where you can talk to us, tell us what you think is going to win Best Picture, or answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Kingsman, The Golden Circle, what's your favorite pop culture British person in a suit?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.